The next evening, Jesse said in a small voice,
"I've been reading the Bible, Lige."
"What?" For a moment, Bailey was honestly bewildered.
"The parts about Jezebel."
"Oh, Jesse, I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. I was being childish."
"No, no."
She pushed his hand from her waist and sat on the couch, cool and upright, with a definite space between them.
"It's good to know the truth. I don't want to be fooled by not knowing, so I read about her. She was a wicked woman, Lige."
"Well, her enemies wrote those chapters. We don't know her side."
"She killed all the prophets of the Lord she could lay her hands on."
"So they say she did." Bailey felt about in his pocket for a stick of chewing gum. In later years, he abandoned that habit because Jesse said that with his long face and sad brown eyes, it made him look like an old cow stuck with an unpleasant wad of grass it couldn't swallow and wouldn't spit out. He said, "If you want her side, I could think of some arguments for you. She valued the religion of her ancestors who had been in the land long before the Hebrews came. The Hebrews had their own God, and what's more, it was an exclusive God. They weren't content to worship him themselves. They wanted everyone in reach to worship him as well. Jezebel was a conservative, sticking to the old beliefs against the new ones. After all, if the new beliefs had a higher moral content, the old ones were more emotionally satisfying. The fact that she killed priests just marks her as a child of her times. It was the usual method of proselytization in those days. If you read 1 Kings, you must remember that Elijah, my namesake this time, had a contest with 850 prophets of Baal to see which could bring down fire from heaven. Elijah won and promptly ordered the crowd of onlookers to kill the 850 Baalites. And they did." Jesse bit her lip.
"What about Naboth's vineyard, Lige? Here was this Naboth, not bothering anybody, except that he refused to sell the king his vineyard, so Jezebel arranged to have people perjure themselves and say that Naboth had committed blasphemy or something."
"He was supposed to have blasphemed God and the king," said Bailey.
"Yes, so they confiscated his property after they executed him."
"That was wrong. Of course, in modern times, Naboth would have been handled quite easily. If the city wanted his property, or even if one of the medieval nations had wanted his property, the courts would have ordered him off, had him removed by force if necessary, and paid him whatever they considered a fair price. King Ahab didn't have that way out. Still, Jezebel's solution was wrong. The only excuse for her is that Ahab was sick and unhappy over the situation, and she felt that her love for her husband came ahead of Naboth's welfare. I keep telling you she was the model of a faithful wife." Jesse flung herself away from him, red-faced and angry.
"I think you're mean and spiteful."
He looked at her with complete dismay. "What have I done? What's the matter with you?" She left the apartment without answering and spent the evening and half the night at the sub-etheric video levels, traveling petulantly from showing to showing and using up a 2-month supply of her quota allowance and her husband's to boot. When she came back to a still wakeful Lige Bailey, she had nothing further to say to him. It occurred to Bailey later, much later, that he had utterly smashed an important part of Jessie's life. Her name had signified something intriguingly wicked to her. It was a delightful make-weight for her prim, over-respectable past. It gave her an aroma of licentiousness, and she adored that. But it was gone. She never mentioned her full name again, not to Lige, not to her friends, and maybe, for all Bailey knew, not even to herself. She was Jessie, and took to signing her name so. As the days passed, she began speaking to him again, and after a week or so their relationship was on the old footing, and with all subsequent quarrels, nothing ever reached that one bad spot of intensity. Only once was there even an indirect reference to the matter. It was in her 8th month of pregnancy. She had left her own position as dietitian's assistant in Section Kitchen A23 and, with unaccustomed time on her hands, was amusing herself in speculation and preparation for the baby's birth. She said one evening,
"What about Bentley?"
"Pardon me, dear," said Bailey, looking up from a sheaf of work he had brought home with him. with an additional mouth soon to feed and Jesse's pay stopped and his own promotions to the non-clerical levels as far off, seemingly, as ever, extra work was necessary.
I mean, if the baby's a boy, what about Bentley as a name?
Bailey pulled down the corners of his mouth. Bentley, Bailey? Don't you think the names are too similar?
I don't know. It has a swing, I think. Besides, the child can always pick out a mill name to suit himself when he gets older.
Well, it's all right with me.
Are you sure? I mean, maybe you wanted him to be named Elijah.
And be called Junior? I don't think that's a good idea. He can name his son Elijah if he wants to. Then Jesse said,
"There's just one thing,"
and stopped. After an interval, he looked up. "What one thing?" She did not quite meet his eye, but she said, forcefully enough,
"Bentley isn't a Bible name, is it?"
"No," said Bailey. "I'm quite sure it isn't."
"All right, then. I don't want any Bible names."
And that was the only harking back that took place from that time to the day when Elijah Bailey was coming home with robot Daniil Oliva, when he had been married for more than 18 years, and when his son, Bentley Bailey, middle name still unchosen, was past 16. Bailey paused before the large double door on which there glowed in large letters, "Personal, Men." In smaller letters were written, "Subsections 1A to 1E. In still smaller letters, just above the key slit, it stated, "In case of loss of key, communicate at once with 27-101-51. A man inched past them, inserted an aluminum sliver into the key slit, and walked in. He closed the door behind him, making no attempt to hold it open for Bailey. Had he done so, Bailey would have been seriously offended. By strong custom, men disregarded one another's presence entirely, either within or just outside the personals. Bailey remembered one of the more interesting marital confidences to have been Jessie's, telling him that the situation was quite different at women's personals. She was always saying,
"I met Josephine Greeley at personal, and she said..."
It was one of the penalties of civic advancement that when the Baileys were granted permission for the activation of a small washbowl in their bedroom, Jesse's social life suffered. Bailey said, without completely masking his embarrassment, "Please wait out here, Daniil." "Do you intend washing?" asked R. Daniil. Bailey squirmed and thought, "Damned robot. If they were briefing him on everything under steel, why didn't they teach him manners? I'll be responsible if he ever says anything like this to anyone else." He said, "I'll shower. It gets crowded evenings. I'll lose time then. If I get it done now, we'll have the whole evening before us." R. Daniil's face maintained its repose. "Is it part of the social custom that I wait outside?" Bailey's embarrassment deepened. "Why need you go in for no purpose?"
"Oh, I understand you. Yes, of course. Nevertheless, Elijah, my hands grow dirty, too, and I will wash them."
He indicated his palms, holding them out before him. They were pink and plump, with the proper creases. They bore every mark of excellent and meticulous workmanship, and were as clean as need be. Bailey said, "We have a wash basin in the apartment, you know." He said it casually. Snobbery would be lost on a robot.
"Thank you for your kindness. On the whole, however, I think it would be preferable to make use of this place. If I am to live with you men of Earth, it is best that I adopt as many of your customs and attitudes as I can."
"Come on in, then." The bright cheerfulness of the interior was a sharp contrast to the busy utilitarianism of most of the rest of the city, but this time the effect was lost on Bailey's consciousness. He whispered to Daniil,
"I may take up to half an hour or so. Wait for me."
He started away, then returned to add,
"And listen, don't talk to anybody and don't look at anybody. Not a word, not a glance. It's a custom."
He looked hurriedly about to make certain that his own small conversation had not been noted, was not being met by shocked glances. Nobody, fortunately, was in the anti-corridor. And, after all, it was only the anti-corridor. He hurried down it feeling vaguely dirty, past the common chambers to the private stalls. It had been 5 years now since he had been awarded one, large enough to contain a shower, a small laundry, and other necessities. It even had a small projector that could be keyed in for the news films. "A home away from home," he had joked when it was first made available to him. But now he often wondered how he would bear the adjustment back to the more Spartan existence of the common chambers if his stall privileges were ever canceled. He pressed the button that activated the laundry and the smooth face of the meter lighted. Ardenil was waiting patiently when Bailey returned with a scrubbed body, clean underwear, a freshened shirt, and generally a feeling of greater comfort.
"No trouble?"
Bailey asked, when they were well outside the door and able to talk.
"None at all, Elijah," said R. Daniil.
Jessie was at the door, smiling nervously. Bailey kissed her.
"Jessie," he mumbled, "this is my new partner, Daniil Oliva."
Jessie held out a hand, which R. Daniil took and released. She turned to her husband, then looked timidly at R. Daniil. She said,
"Won't you sit down, Mr. Oliva? I must talk to my husband on family matters. It'll take just a minute. I hope you won't mind."
Her hand was on Bailey's sleeve. He followed her into the next room. She said in a hurried whisper,
"You aren't hurt, are you? I've been so worried ever since the broadcast."
"What broadcast?"
"It came through nearly an hour ago, about the riot at the shoe counter. They said two plainclothesmen stopped it. I knew you were coming home with a partner, and this was right in our subsection, and right when you were coming home, and I thought they were making it better than it was, and you were—"
"Please, Jessie, you see, I'm perfectly all right."
Jessie caught hold of herself with an effort. She said, shakily,
"Your partner isn't from your division, is he?"
"No,"
replied Bailey, miserably.
"He's a complete stranger."
"How do I treat him?"
"Like anybody else. He's just my partner, that's all."
He said it so unconvincingly that Jessie's quick eyes narrowed.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing. Come, let's go back into the living room. It'll begin to look queer."
Lige Bailey felt a little uncertain about the apartment now. Until this very moment, he had felt no qualms. In fact, he had always been proud of it. It had three large rooms. The living room, for instance, was an ample 15 feet by 18. There was a closet in each room. One of the main ventilation ducts passed directly by. It meant a little rumbling noise on rare occasions, but, on the other hand, assured first-rate temperature control and well-conditioned air. Nor was it too far from either personal, which was a prime convenience. But with the creature from worlds beyond space sitting in the midst of it, Bailey was suddenly uncertain. The apartment seemed mean and cramped. Jessie said, with a gaiety that was slightly synthetic,
"Have you and Mr. Oliva eaten, Lige?"
"As a matter of fact," said Bailey quickly, "Daniil will not be eating with us. I'll eat, though."
Jessie accepted the situation without trouble. With food supplies so narrowly controlled and rationing tighter than ever, it was good form to refuse another's hospitality. She said,
"I hope you won't mind our eating, Mr. Oliva. Lige Bentley and I generally eat at the community kitchen. It's much more convenient, and there's more variety, you see, and just between you and me, bigger helpings, too. But then Lige and I do have permission to eat in our apartment 3 times a week if we want to. Lige is quite successful at the Bureau, and we have very nice status, and I thought that just for this occasion, if you wanted to join us, we would have a little private feast of our own, though I do think that people who overdo their privacy privileges are just a bit antisocial, you know."
R. Daniil listened politely. Bailey said, with an undercover, shushing wiggle of his fingers,
"Jessie, I'm hungry."
R. Daniil said,
"Would I be breaking a custom, Mrs. Bailey, if I addressed you by your given name?"
"Why, no, of course not."
Jessie folded a table out of the wall and plugged the plate warmer into the central depression on the tabletop.
"You just go ahead and call me Jessie all you feel like, Daniil."
She giggled. Bailey felt savage. The situation was getting rapidly more uncomfortable. Jessie thought R. Daniil a man. The thing would be someone to boast of and talk about in women's personal. He was good-looking, in a wooden way, too, and Jesse was pleased with his deference. Anyone could see that. Bailey wondered about R. Daniil's impression of Jesse. She hadn't changed much in 18 years, or at least not to Lige Bailey. She was heavier, of course, and her figure had lost much of its youthful vigor. There were lines at the angles of the mouth and a trace of heaviness about her cheeks. Her hair was more conservatively styled and a dimmer brown than it had once been. But that's all beside the point, thought Bailey, somberly. On the outer worlds, the women were tall and as slim and regal as the men. Or at least, the book films had them so, and that must be the kind of women R. Daniil was used to. But R. Daniil seemed quite unperturbed by Jesse's conversation, her appearance, or her appropriation of his name. He said, "Are you sure that is proper? The name Jesse seems to be a diminutive. Perhaps its use is restricted to members of your immediate circle, and I would be more proper if I used your full given name." Jesse, who was breaking open the insulating wrapper surrounding the dinner ration, bent her head over the task in sudden concentration.
"Just Jesse," she said tightly. "Everyone calls me that. There's nothing else."
"Very well, Jesse." The door opened, and a youngster entered cautiously. His eyes found R. Daniil almost at once.
"Dad?" said the boy uncertainly.
"My son, Bentley," said Bailey in a low voice. "This is Mr. Oliva, Ben."
"He's your partner, huh, Dad? How do you do, Mr. Oliva?"
Ben's eyes grew large and luminous.
"Say, Dad, what happened down in the shoe place? The newscast said—"
"Don't ask any questions now, Ben," interposed Bailey sharply. Bentley's face fell, and he looked toward his mother, who motioned him to a seat.
"Did you do what I told you, Bentley?"
she asked, when he sat down. Her hands moved caressingly over his hair. It was as dark as his father's, and he was going to have his father's height, but all the rest of him was hers. He had Jessie's oval face, her hazel eyes, her light-hearted way of looking at life.
"Well, sure, Mom," said Bentley, hitching himself forward a bit to look into the double dish from which savory vapors were already rising. "What we got to eat?" "Not Zymoveal again, Mom. Huh, Mom?" "There's nothing wrong with Zymoveal," said Jesse, her lips pressing together. "Now, you just eat what's put before you, and let's not have any comments."
It was quite obvious they were having Zymoveal. Bailey took his own seat. He himself would have preferred something other than Zymoveal, with its sharp flavor and definite aftertaste, but Jesse had explained her problem before this.
"Well, I just can't, Lige," she had said. "I live right here on these levels all day, and I can't make enemies or life wouldn't be bearable. They know I used to be assistant dietitian, and if I just walked off with steak or chicken every other week, when there's hardly anyone else on the floor that has private eating privileges, even on Sunday, they'd say it was pull or friends in the prep room. It would be talk, 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 and I wouldn't be able to put my nose out the door or visit personal in peace. As it is, Zymoveal and Protoveg are very good. They're well-balanced nourishment, with no waste. And as a matter of fact, they're full of vitamins and minerals and everything anyone needs. And we can have all the chicken we want when we eat in community on the Chicken Tuesdays."
Bailey gave in easily. It was, as Jesse said, the first problem of living is to minimize friction with the crowds that surround you on all sides. Bentley was a little harder to convince. On this occasion, he said,
"Gee, Mom, why can't I use Dad's ticket and eat in community myself? I just as soon—"
Jessie shook her head in annoyance and said,
"I'm surprised at you, Bentley. What would people say if they saw you eating by yourself as though your own family weren't good enough for you, or had thrown you out of the apartment?" "Well, gosh, it's none of people's business,"
Bailey said, with a nervous edge in his voice.
"Do as your mother tells you, Bentley."
Bentley shrugged unhappily. R. Daniil said, suddenly from the other side of the room, "Have I the family's permission to view these book films during your meal?"
"Oh, sure,"
said Bentley, slipping away from the table, a look of instant interest upon his face.
"They're mine. I got them from the library on special school permit. I'll get you my viewer. It's a pretty good one. Dad gave it to me for my last birthday."
He brought it to R. Daniil and said,
"Are you interested in robots, Mr. Olivaugh?"
Bailey dropped his spoon and bent to pick it up. R. Daniil said, "Yes, Bentley, I am quite interested."
"Oh, then you'll like these. They're all about robots. I've got to write an essay on them for school, so I'm doing research. It's quite a complicated subject," he said importantly. "I'm against them myself."
"Sit down, Bentley," said Bailey desperately. "And don't bother Mr. Olivaugh."
"He's not bothering me, Elijah. I'd like to talk to you about the problem, Bentley, another time. Your father and I will be very busy tonight."
"Well, thanks, Mr. Olivaugh."
Bentley took a seat, and with a look of distaste in his mother's direction, broke off a portion of the crumbly pink Zymoveal with his fork. Bailey thought, "Busy tonight?" Then, with a resounding shock, he remembered his job. He thought of a spacer lying dead in Spacetown and realized that for hours he had been so involved with his own dilemma that he had forgotten the cold fact of murder. Chapter 5. Analysis of a Murder. Jessie said goodbye to them. She was wearing a formal hat and a little jacket of karate fiber as she said,
"I hope you'll excuse me, Mr. Olivaugh. I know you have a great deal to discuss with Lige."
She pushed her son ahead of her as she opened the door.
"When will you be back, Jessie?" asked Bailey.
She paused.
"When do you want me to be back?"
"Well, no use staying out all night. Why don't you come back your usual time, midnight or so?"
He looked doubtfully at R. Daniil. R. Daniil nodded.
"I regret having to drive you from your home."
"Oh, don't worry about that, Mr. Olivaugh. You're not driving me out at all. This is my usual evening out with the girls anyway. Come on, Ben."
The youngster was rebellious.
"Oh, why the dickens do I have to go anyway? I'm not going to bother them. Nuts. Now do as I say." "Well, why can't I go to the Etherix along with you?" "Because I'm going with some friends, and you've got other things."
The door closed behind them. And now the moment had come. Bailey had put it off in his mind. He had thought, first, let's meet the robot and see what he's like. Then it was, let's get him home. And then, let's eat. But now it was all over, and there was no room for further delay. It was down at last to the question of murder, of interstellar complications, of possible raises and ratings, of possible disgrace. And he had no way of even beginning except to turn to the robot for help. His fingernails moved aimlessly on the table, which had not been returned to its wall recess. R. Daniil said,
"How secure are we against being overheard?"
Bailey looked up, surprised.
"No one would listen to what's proceeding in another man's apartment."
"It is not your custom to eavesdrop?"
"It just isn't done, Daniil. You might as well suppose they'd look in your plate while you're eating."
"Or that they would commit murder."
"What?"
"It is against your customs to kill, is it not, Elijah?"
Bailey felt anger rising.
"See here, if we're going to be partners, don't try to imitate spacer arrogance. There's no room for it in you, R. Daniil."
He could not resist emphasizing the R.
"I am sorry if I have hurt your feelings, Elijah. My intention was only to indicate that since human beings are occasionally capable of murder in defiance of custom, they may be able to violate custom for the smaller impropriety of eavesdropping."
"The apartment is adequately insulated," said Bailey, still frowning. "You haven't heard anything from the apartments on any side of us, have you? Well, they won't hear us either. Besides, why should anyone think anything of importance is going on here?"
"Let us not underestimate the enemy."
Bailey shrugged. "Well, let's get started. My information is sketchy, so I can spread on my hand without much trouble. I know that a man named Raj Namena Sartan, a citizen of the planet Aurora, and a resident of Spacetown, has been murdered by person or persons unknown. I understand that it is the opinion of the spacers that this is not an isolated event. Am I right?"
"You are quite right, Elijah."
"They tie it up with recent attempts to sabotage the spacer-sponsored project of converting us to an integrated human-robot society on the model of the Outer Worlds, and assume the murder was the product of a well-organized terrorist group."
"Yes."
"All right.
Then to begin with, is this spacer assumption necessarily true? Why can't the murder have been the work of an isolated fanatic? There is strong anti-robot sentiment on Earth, but there are no organized parties advocating violence of this sort.
Not openly, perhaps. No.
Even a secret organization dedicated to the destruction of robots and robot factories would have the common sense to realize that the worst thing they could do would be to murder a spacer. It seems much more likely to have been the work of an unbalanced mind.
Ardenil listened carefully, then said, I think the weight of probability is against the fanatic theory. The person killed was too well chosen, and the time of the murder too appropriate for anything but deliberate planning on the part of an organized group.
Well, then you've got more information than I have. Spill it.
Your phraseology is obscure, but I think I understand. I will have to explain some of the background to you. As seen from Spacetown, Elijah, relations with Earth are unsatisfactory.
Tough, muttered Bailey.
I have been told that when Spacetown was first established, it was taken for granted by most of our people that Earth would be willing to adopt the integrated society that has worked so well on the outer worlds. Even after the first riots, we thought that it was only a matter of your people getting over the first shock of novelty. That has not proven to be the case. Even with the cooperation of the terrestrial government and of most of the various city governments, resistance has been continuous and progress has been very slow. Naturally, this has been a matter of great concern to our people.
Out of altruism, I suppose, said Bailey.
Not entirely, said Ardenil. Although it is good of you to attribute worthy motives to them. It is our common belief that a healthy and modernized Earth would be of great benefit to the whole galaxy. At least, it is the common belief among our people at Spacetown. I must admit that there are strong elements opposed to them on the outer worlds.
What? Disagreement among the spacers?
Certainly. There are some who think that a modernized Earth will be a dangerous and an imperialistic Earth. This is particularly true among the populations of those older worlds which are closer to Earth and have greater reason to remember the first few centuries of interstellar travel when their worlds were controlled politically and economically by Earth.
Bailey sighed. Ancient history. Are they really worried? Are they still kicking at us for things that happened 1,000 years ago?
Humans, said Ardenil, have their own peculiar makeup. They are not as reasonable, in many ways, as we robots, since their circuits are not as pre-planned. I am told that this, too, has its advantages.
Perhaps it may, said Bailey dryly.
You are in a better position to know, said Ardenil. In any case, continuing failure on Earth has strengthened the nationalist parties on the outer worlds. They say that it is obvious that Earthmen are different from spacers and cannot be fitted into the same traditions. They say that if we imposed robots on Earth by superior force, we would be loosing destruction on the galaxy. One thing they never forget, you see, is that Earth's population is 8 billions, while the total population of the 50 outer worlds combined is scarcely more than 5.5 billions. Our people here, particularly Dr. Sarton...
He was a doctor?
A doctor of sociology, specializing in robotics, and a very brilliant man.
I see. Go on.
As I said, Dr. Sarton and the others realized that Spacetown and all it meant would not exist much longer if such sentiments on the outer worlds were allowed to grow by feeding on our continued failure. Dr. Sarton felt that the time had come to make a supreme effort to understand the psychology of the Earthman. It is easy to say that the Earth people are innately conservative, and to speak tritely of the unchanging Earth and the inscrutable terrestrial mind, but that is only evading the problem. Dr. Sarton said it was ignorant speaking, and that we could not dismiss the Earthman with a proverb or a bromide. He said the spacers who were trying to remake Earth must abandon the isolation of Spacetown and mingle with Earthmen. They must live as they, think as they, be as they.
Bailey said, The spacers? Impossible.
You are quite right, said Ardenil. Despite his views, Dr. Sarton himself could not have brought himself to enter any of the cities, and he knew it. He would have been unable to bear the hugeness and the crowds. Even if he had been forced inside at the point of a blaster,
The externals would have weighed him down so that he could never have penetrated the inner truths for which he sought.
"What about the way they're always worrying about disease?" demanded Bailey. "Don't forget that. I don't think there's one of them that would risk entering a city on that account alone."
"There is that, too. Disease, in the earthly sense, is unknown on the outer worlds, and the fear of the unknown is always morbid. Dr. Sarton appreciated all of this, but nevertheless, he insisted on the necessity of growing to know the Earthman and his way of life intimately."
"He seems to have worked himself into a corner."
"Not quite. The objections to entering the city hold for human spacers. Robot spacers are another thing entirely."
Bailey thought, "I keep forgetting, damn it." Aloud, he said, "Oh?"
"Yes," said R. Daniil. "We are more flexible naturally, at least in this respect. We can be designed for adaptation to an earthly life. By being built into a particularly close similarity to the human externals, we could be accepted by Earthmen and allowed a closer view of their life."
"And you yourself," began Bailey in sudden enlightenment,
"am just such a robot." For a year, Dr. Sarton had been working upon the design and construction of such robots. I was the first of his robots, and so far the only one. Unfortunately, my education is not yet complete. I have been hurried into my role prematurely as a result of the murder."
"And not all spacer robots are like you. I mean, some look more like robots and less like humans, right?"
"Why, naturally. The outward appearance is dependent on a robot's function. My own function requires a very manlike appearance, and I have it. Others are different, although all are humanoid. Certainly they are more humanoid than the distressingly primitive models I saw at the shoe counter. Are all your robots like that?"
"More or less," said Bailey. "You don't approve?"
"Of course not. It is difficult to accept a gross parody of the human form as an intellectual equal." "Can your factories do no better?"
"I'm sure they can, Daniil. I think we just prefer to know when we're dealing with a robot and when we're not."
He stared directly into the robot's eyes as he said that. They were bright and moist, as a human's would be, but it seemed to Bailey that their gaze was steady and did not flicker slightly from point to point as a man's would. R. Daniil said, "I am hopeful that in time I will grow to understand that point of view." For a moment, Bailey thought there was sarcasm in the sentence, then dismissed the possibility. "In any case," said R. Daniil, "Dr. Sarton saw clearly the fact that it was a case for C-fee."
"C-fee? What's that?"
"Just the chemical symbols for the elements carbon and iron, Elijah. Carbon is the basis of human life, and iron of robot life. It becomes easy to speak of C-fee when you wish to express a culture that combines the best of the two on an equal but parallel basis."
"C-fee. Do you write it with a hyphen, or how?"
"No, Elijah. A diagonal line between the two is the accepted way. It symbolizes neither one nor the other, but a mixture of the two, without priority."
Against his will, Bailey found himself interested. Formal education on Earth included virtually no information on outer world history or sociology after the Great Rebellion that made them independent of the Mother Planet. The popular book-film romances, to be sure, had their stock outer world characters. The visiting tycoon, choleric and eccentric, the beautiful heiress, invariably smitten by the Earthman's charms and drowning disdain in love, the arrogant spacer rival, wicked and forever beaten. These were worthless pictures, since they denied even the most elementary and well-known truths, that spacers never entered cities and spacer women virtually never visited Earth. For the first time in his life, Bailey was stirred by an odd curiosity. What was spacer life really like? He brought his mind back to the issue at hand with something of an effort. He said,
"I think I get what you're driving at. Your Dr. Sarton was attacking the problem of Earth's conversion to C-fee from a new and promising angle. Our conservative groups, or medievalists, as they call themselves, were perturbed. They were afraid he might succeed, so they killed him. That's the motivation that makes it an organized plot and not an isolated outrage, right?"
"I would put it about like that, Elijah. Yes." Bailey whistled thoughtfully under his breath. His long fingers tapped lightly against the table. Then he shook his head.
It won't wash. It won't wash at all.
Pardon me. I do not understand you.
I'm trying to get the picture. An Earthman walks into Spacetown, walks up to Dr. Sartan, blasts him, and walks out. I just don't see it. Surely the entrance to Spacetown is guarded.
R. Daniil nodded. I think it is safe to say that no Earthman can possibly have passed through the entrance illegally.
Then where does that leave you?
It would leave us in a confusing position, Elijah, if the entrance were the only way of reaching Spacetown from New York City. Bailey watched his partner thoughtfully.
I don't get you. It's the only connection between the two.
Directly between the two, yes. R. Daniil waited a moment, then said,
You do not follow me, is that not so?
That is so. I don't get you at all.
Well, if it will not offend you, I will try to explain myself. May I have a piece of paper and a writer?
Thank you.
Look here, partner Elijah. I will draw a big circle and label it New York City. Now, tangent to it, I will draw a small circle and label it Spacetown. Here, where they touch, I draw an arrowhead and label it Barrier. Now, do you see no other connection?
Bailey said,
Of course not. There is no other connection.
In a way, said the robot, I am glad to hear you say this. It is in accordance with what I have been taught about terrestrial ways of thinking. The barrier is the only direct connection. But both the city and Spacetown are open to the countryside in all directions. It is possible for a terrestrial to leave the city at any of numerous exits and strike out cross-country to Spacetown, where no barrier will stop him.
The tip of Bailey's tongue touched his upper lip, and for a moment stayed there. Then he said,
Cross-country?
Yes.
Cross-country? Alone?
Why not?
Walking?
Undoubtedly walking. Walking would offer the least chance of detection. The murder took place early in the working day, and the trip was undoubtedly negotiated in the hours before dawn.
Impossible. There isn't a man in the city who would do it. Leave the city alone?
Ordinarily, it would seem unlikely. Yes, we spacers know that. It is why we guard only the entrance. Even in the Great Riot, your people attacked only at the barrier that then protected the entrance. Not one left the city.
Well, then?
But now we are dealing with an unusual situation. It is not the blind attack of a mob following the line of least resistance, but the organized attempt of a small group to strike, deliberately, at the unguarded point. It explains why, as you say, a terrestrial could enter Spacetown, walk up to his victim, kill him, and walk away. The man attacked through a complete blind spot on our part.
Bailey shook his head.
That's too unlikely. Have your people done anything to check that theory?
Yes, we have. Your commissioner of police was present almost at the time of the murder.
I know, he told me so.
That, Elijah, is another example of the timeliness of the murder. Your commissioner has cooperated with Dr. Sartan in the past, and he was the Earthman with whom Dr. Sartan planned to make initial arrangements concerning the infiltration of your city by ours, such as myself. The appointment for that morning was to concern that. The murder, of course, stopped those plans, at least temporarily, and the fact that it happened when your own commissioner of police was actually within Spacetown made the entire situation more difficult and embarrassing for Earth, and for our own people, too. But that is not what I started to say. Your commissioner was present. We said to him, The man must have come cross-country. Like you, he said, Impossible, or perhaps unthinkable. He was quite disturbed, of course, and perhaps that may have made it difficult for him to see the essential point. Nevertheless, we forced him to begin checking that possibility almost at once.
Bailey thought of the commissioner's broken glasses, and even in the middle of somber thoughts, a corner of his mouth twitched.
Poor Julius. Yes, he would be disturbed. Of course, there would be no way for Enderby to have explained the situation to the lofty spacers who looked upon physical disability as a peculiarly disgusting attribute of the non-genetically selected Earthman. At least he couldn't without losing face, and face was valuable to Police Commissioner Julius Enderby.
Well, Earthmen had to stick together in some respects. The robot would never find out about Enderby's nearsightedness from Bailey. Ardeniel continued.
One by one, the various exit points from the city were investigated. Do you know how many there are, Elijah?
Bailey shook his head, then hazarded. 20?
502.
What?
Originally, there were many more. 502 are all that remain functional. Your city represents a slow growth, Elijah. It was once open to the sky, and people crossed from city to country freely.
Of course, I know that.
Well, when it was first enclosed, there were many exits left. 502 still remain. The rest are built over or blocked up. We are not counting, of course, the entrance points for air freight.
Well, what of the exit points?
It was hopeless. They are unguarded. We could find no official who was in charge or who considered them under his jurisdiction. It seemed as though no one even knew they existed. A man could have walked out of any of them at any time and returned at will. He would never have been detected.
Anything else? The weapon was gone, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
Any clues of any sort?
None. We have investigated the ground surrounding Spacetown thoroughly. The robots on the truck farms were quite useless as possible witnesses. They are little more than automatic farm machinery, scarcely humanoid, and there were no humans.
Uh-huh. What next?
Having failed so far at one end, Spacetown, we will work at the other, New York City. It will be our duty to track down all possible subversive groups, to sift all dissident organizations.
How much time do you intend to spend?
Interrupted Bailey. As little as possible, as much as necessary.
Well, said Bailey, thoughtfully, I wish you had another partner in this mess.
I do not, said Ardeniel. The Commissioner spoke very highly of your loyalty and ability.
It was nice of him,
said Bailey sardonically.
He thought, poor Julius, I'm on his conscience and he tries hard.
We didn't rely entirely on him, said Ardeniel. We checked your records. You have expressed yourself openly against the use of robots in your department.
Oh? Do you object?
Not at all. Your opinions are obviously your own. But it made it necessary for us to check your psychological profile very closely. We know that, although you dislike ours intensely, you will work with one if you conceive it to be your duty. You have an extraordinarily high loyalty aptitude and a respect for legitimate authority. It is what we need. Commissioner Enderby judged you well.
You have no personal resentment toward my anti-robot sentiments?
Ardeniel said, if they do not prevent you from working with me and helping me do what is required of me, how can they matter? Bailey felt stopped. He said belligerently,
well, then, if I pass the test, how about you? What makes you a detective?
I do not understand you.
You were designed as an information-gathering machine, a man imitation to record the facts of human life for the spacers.
That is a good beginning for an investigator, is it not? To be an information-gathering machine?
A beginning, maybe, but it's not all there is, by a long shot.
Well, to be sure, there has been a final adjustment of my circuits.
I'd be curious to hear the details of that, Daniil.
That is easy enough. A particularly strong drive has been inserted into my motivation banks. A desire for justice.
Justice? Cried Bailey.
The irony faded from his face and was replaced by a look of the most earnest distrust. But Ardeniel turned swiftly in his chair and stared at the door. Someone is out there.
Someone was.
The door opened, and Jesse, pale and thin-lipped, walked in. Bailey was startled.
Why, Jesse, is anything wrong?
She stood there, eyes not meeting his.
I'm sorry. I had to...
Her voice trailed off.
Where's Bentley?
He is to stay the night in the youth hall.
Bailey said,
why? I didn't tell you to do that.
You said your partner would stay the night. I felt he would need Bentley's room.
Ardeniel said, there was no necessity, Jesse. Jesse lifted her eyes to Ardeniel's face, staring at it earnestly. Bailey looked at his fingertips,
sick at what might follow, somehow unable to interpose. The momentary silence pressed thickly on his eardrums, and then, far away, as though through folds of plastics, he heard his wife say,
"I think you are a robot, Daniil."
And R. Daniil replied, in a voice as calm as ever, "I am." Chapter 6. Whispers in a Bedroom. On the uppermost levels of some of the wealthiest subsections of the city are the natural solariums, where a partition of quartz with a movable metal shield excludes the air but lets in the sunlight. There the wives and daughters of the city's highest administrators and executives may tan themselves. There a unique thing happens every evening. Night falls. In the rest of the city, including the UV solariums, where the millions, in strict sequence of allotted time, may occasionally expose themselves to the artificial wavelengths of arc lights, there are only the arbitrary cycles of hours. The business of the city might easily continue in 3 8-hour or 4 6-hour shifts, by day and night alike. Light and work could easily proceed endlessly. There are always civic reformers who periodically suggest such a thing in the interests of economy and efficiency. The notion is never accepted. Much of the earlier habits of earthly society have been given up in the interests of that same economy and efficiency. Space, privacy, even much of free will. They are the products of civilization, however, and not more than 10,000 years old. The adjustment of sleep to night, however, is as old as man, 1,000,000 years. The habit is not easy to give up. Although the evening is unseen, apartment lights dim as the hours of darkness pass and the city's pulse sinks. Though no one can tell noon from midnight by any cosmic phenomenon along the enclosed avenues of the city, mankind follows the mute partitionings of the hour hand. The expressways empty. The noise of life sinks. The moving mob among the colossal alleys melts away. New York City lies in Earth's unnoticed shadow, and its population sleeps. Elijah Bailey did not sleep. He lay in bed, and there was no light in his apartment, but that was as far as it went. Jesse lay next to him, motionless in the darkness. He had not felt nor heard her move. On the other side of the wall sat, stood, lay, Bailey wondered which, R. Daniil Olivaugh. Bailey whispered, "Jesse." Then again, "Jesse." The dark figure beside him stirred slightly under the sheet.
"What do you want?"
"Jesse, don't make it worse for me."
"You might have told me."
"How could I? I was planning to when I could think of a way. Jehoshaphat, Jesse! Shh!" Bailey's voice returned to its whisper.
"How'd you find out? Won't you tell me?"
Jesse turned toward him. He could sense her eyes looking through the darkness at him.
"Lige."
Her voice was scarcely more than a stirring of air.
"Can he hear us? That thing?"
"Not if we whisper."
"How do you know? Maybe he has special ears to pick up tiny sounds. Spacer robots can do all sorts of things."
Bailey knew that. The pro-robot propaganda was forever stressing the miraculous feats of the spacer robots, their endurance, their extra senses, their service to humanity in 100 novel ways. Personally, he thought that approach defeated itself. Earthmen hated the robots all the more for their superiority. He whispered,
"Not Daniil. They made him human-type on purpose. They wanted him to be accepted as a human being, so he must have only human senses."
"How do you know?"
"If he had extra senses, there would be too much danger of his giving himself away as non-human by accident. He would do too much, know too much."
"Well, maybe."
Silence fell again. A minute passed, and Bailey tried a second time.
"Jesse, if you'll just let things be until—" "Look, dear, it's unfair of you to be angry."
"Angry? Oh, Lige, you fool. I'm not angry. I'm scared. I'm scared clean to death.
She made a gulping sound and clutched at the neck of his pajamas. For a while they clung together, and Bailey's growing sense of injury evaporated into a troubled concern.
Why, Jesse? There's nothing to be worried about. He's harmless. I swear he is.
Can't you get rid of him, Lige?
You know I can't. It's department business. How can I?
What kind of business, Lige? Tell me.
Now, Jesse, I'm surprised at you.
He groped for her cheek in the darkness and patted it. It was wet. Using his pajama sleeve, he carefully wiped her eyes.
Now look, he said tenderly. You're being a baby.
Tell them at the department to have someone else do it. Whatever it is, please, Lige.
Bailey's voice hardened a bit.
Jesse, you've been a policeman's wife long enough to know an assignment is an assignment.
Well, why did it have to be you?
Julius Enderby, she stiffened in his arms.
I might have known. Why can't you tell Julius Enderby to have someone else do the dirty work just once? You stand for too much, Lige, and this is just...
all right, he said soothingly.
She subsided, quivering. Bailey thought,
she'll never understand.
Julius Enderby had been a fighting word with them since their engagement. Enderby had been two classes ahead of Bailey at the City School of Administrative Studies. They had been friends. When Bailey had taken his battery of aptitude tests and neuroanalysis and found himself in line for the police force, he found Enderby there ahead of him. Enderby had already moved into the plainclothes division. Bailey followed Enderby, but at a continually greater distance. It was no one's fault, precisely. Bailey was capable enough, efficient enough, but he lacked something that Enderby had. Enderby fit the administrative machine perfectly. He was one of those persons who was born for a hierarchy, who was just naturally comfortable in a bureaucracy. The commissioner wasn't a great brain, and Bailey knew it. He had his childish peculiarities, his intermittent rash of ostentatious medievalism, for instance. But he was smooth with others. He offended no one. He took orders gracefully. He gave them with the proper mixture of gentleness and firmness. He even got along with the spacers. He was, perhaps, over-obsequious to them. Bailey himself could never have dealt with them for half a day without getting into a state of bristle. He was sure of that, even though he had never really spoken to a spacer. But they trusted him, and that made him extremely useful to the city. So, in a civil service where smooth and sociable performance was more useful than an individualistic competence, Enderby went up the scale quickly, and was at the commissioner level when Bailey himself was nothing more than a C5. Bailey did not resent the contrast, though he was human enough to regret it. Enderby did not forget their earlier friendship, and in his queer way tried to make up for his success by doing what he could for Bailey. The assignment of partnership with R. Daniil was an example of it. It was tough and unpleasant, but there was no question that it carried within it the germs of tremendous advance. The commissioner might have given the chance to someone else. His own talk that morning of needing a favor masked but did not hide that fact. Jesse never saw things that way. On similar occasions in the past, she had said,
"It's your silly loyalty index. I'm so tired of hearing everyone praise you for being so full of a sense of duty. Think of yourself once in a while. I notice the ones on top don't bring up the topic of their own loyalty index."
Bailey lay in bed in a state of stiff wakefulness, letting Jesse calm down. He had to think. He had to be certain of his suspicions. Little things chased one another and fitted together in his mind. Slowly, they were building into a pattern. He felt the mattress give as Jesse stirred.
"Lige."
Her lips were at his ear.
"What?"
"Why don't you resign?"
"Oh, don't be crazy."
"Why not?"
She was suddenly almost eager.
"You can get rid of that horrible robot that way. Just walk in and tell Enderby you're through."
Bailey said coldly,
"I can't resign in the middle of an important case. I can't throw the whole thing down the disposal tube just any time I feel like it.
A trick like that means declassification for cause.
Even so, you can work your way up again. You can do it, Lige. There are a dozen places where you'd fit into service.
Civil service doesn't take men who are declassified for cause. Manual labor is the only thing I can do, the only thing you could do. Bentley would lose all inherited status. For God's sake, Jesse, you don't know what it's like.
I've read about it. I'm not afraid of it,
she mumbled. Oh, you're crazy. You're plain crazy. Bailey could feel himself trembling. There was a familiar flashing picture of his father in his mind's eye. His father, moldering away toward death. Jesse sighed heavily. Bailey's mind turned savagely away from her. In desperation, it returned to the pattern it was constructing. He said tightly,
Jesse, you've got to tell me. How did you find out Danielle was a robot? What made you decide that?
She began,
Well,
and just ran down. It was the third time she had begun to explain and failed. He crushed her hand in his, willing her to speak.
Please, Jesse, what's frightening you?
She said,
I just guessed he was a robot, Lige.
He said,
There wasn't anything to make you guess that, Jesse. You didn't think he was a robot before you left now, did you?
No, but I got to thinking.
Come on, Jesse, what was it?
Well, look, Lige, the girls were talking in the personal. You know how they are, just talking about everything.
Women,
thought Bailey.
Anyway, said Jesse, the rumor is all over town. It must be.
All over town? Bailey felt a quick and savage touch of triumph. Or nearly that. Another piece in place.
It was the way they sounded. They said there was talk about a spacer robot loose in the city. He was supposed to look just like a man and to be working with the police. They even asked me about it. They laughed and said, Does your Lige know anything about it, Jesse? And I laughed and said, Don't be silly. Then we went to the Etherix, and I got to thinking about your new partner. Do you remember those pictures you brought home? The ones Julius Enderby took in Spacetown? To show me what spacers looked like? Well, I got to thinking that's what your partner looked like. It just came to me that that's what he looked like, and I said to myself, Oh, my God! Someone must have recognized him in the shoe department, and he's with Lige. And I just said I had a headache, and I ran.
Bailey said,
Now, Jesse, stop, stop. Get a hold of yourself. Now, why are you afraid? You're not afraid of Danielle himself. You faced up to him when you came home. You faced up to him fine, so...
He stopped speaking. He sat up in bed, eyes uselessly wide in the darkness. He felt his wife move against his side. His hand leaped, found her lips, and pressed against them. She heaved against his grip, her hands grasping his wrist and wrenching. But he leaned down against her the more heavily. Then, suddenly, he released her. She whimpered. He said huskily,
Sorry, Jesse. I was listening.
He was getting out of bed, pulling warm plastifilm over the soles of his feet.
Lige, where are you going? Don't leave me.
It's all right. I'm just going to the door.
The plastofilm made a soft, shuffling noise as he circled the bed. He cracked the door to the living room and waited a long moment. Nothing happened. It was so quiet, he could hear the thin whistle of Jesse's breath from their bed. He could hear the dull rhythm of blood in his ears. Bailey's hand crept through the opening of the door, snaking out to the spot he needed no light to find. His fingers closed upon the knob that controlled the ceiling illumination. He exerted the smallest pressure he could, and the ceiling gleamed dimly, so dimly that the lower half of the living room remained in semi-dusk. He saw enough, however. The main door was closed, and the living room lay lifeless and quiet. He turned the knob back into the off position and moved back to bed. It was all he needed. The pieces fit. The pattern was complete. Jesse pleaded with him.
Lige, what's wrong?
Nothing's wrong, Jesse. Everything's all right. He's not here.
The robot? Do you mean he's gone? For good?
No, no. He'll be back.
And before he does, answer my question.
What question?
What are you afraid of? Jesse said nothing. Bailey grew more insistent. You said you were scared to death.
Of him?
No. We went through that. You weren't afraid of him. And besides, you know quite well a robot cannot hurt a human being.
Her words came slowly.
I thought if everyone knew he was a robot, there might be a riot. We'd be killed.
Why kill us?
You know what riots are like.
They don't even know where the robot is, do they?
They might find out.
And that's what you're afraid of, a riot?
Well, shh!
He pressed Jesse down to the pillow. Then he put his lips to her ear.
He's come back. Now listen, and don't say a word. Everything's fine. He'll be gone in the morning, and he won't be back. There'll be no riot, nothing.
He was almost contented as he said that. Almost completely contented. He felt he could sleep. He thought again, no riot, nothing, and no declassification. And just before he actually fell asleep, he thought, not even a murder investigation, not even that. The whole thing solved. He slept.
Chapter 7. Excursion into Spacetown. Police Commissioner Julius Enderby polished his glasses with exquisite care and placed them upon the bridge of his nose. Bailey thought, that's a good trick. Keeps you busy while you're thinking what to say, and it doesn't cost money the way lighting up a pipe does. And because the thought had entered his mind, he drew out his pipe and dipped into his pinched store of rough cut. One of the few luxury crops still grown on Earth was tobacco, and its end was visibly approaching. Prices had gone up, never down, in Bailey's lifetime. Quotas down, never up. Enderby, having adjusted his glasses, felt for the switch at one end of his desk and flicked his door into one-way transparency for a moment.
Where is he now, by the way?
He told me he wanted to be shown through the department, and I let Jack Tobin do the honors.
Bailey lit his pipe and tightened its baffle carefully. The commissioner, like most non-indulgers, was petty about tobacco smoke.
I hope you didn't tell him Daniil was a robot.
Of course I didn't.
The commissioner did not relax. One hand remained aimlessly busy with the automatic calendar on his desk.
How is it?
He asked, without looking at Bailey.
Middling rough.
I'm sorry, Lige,
Bailey said firmly.
You might have warned me that he looked completely human.
The commissioner looked surprised.
I didn't?
Then, with sudden petulance,
damn it, you should have known. I wouldn't have asked you to have him stay at your house if he looked like our Sammy, now would I?
I know, Commissioner, but I'd never seen a robot like that, and you had. I didn't even know such things were possible. I just wish you'd mentioned it, that's all.
Look, Lige, I'm sorry. I should have told you. You're right. It's just that this job, this whole deal, has me so on edge that half the time I'm just snapping at people for no reason. This Daniil thing is a new type robot. It's still in the experimental stage.
So he explained himself.
Oh. Well, that's it, then.
Bailey tensed a little.
This was it now.
He said, casually, teeth clenched on pipe stem,
Our Daniil has arranged a trip to Spacetown for me.
To Spacetown?
Enderby looked up with instant indignation.
Yes, it's the logical next move, Commissioner. I'd like to see the scene of the crime, ask a few questions.
Enderby shook his head decidedly.
I don't think that's a good idea, Lige. We've gone over the ground. I doubt there's anything new to be learned. And they're strange people. Kid gloves. They've got to be handled with kid gloves. You don't have the experience.
He put a plump hand to his forehead and added, with unexpected fervor,
I hate them.
Bailey inserted hostility into his voice.
Damn it. The robot came here and I should go there. It's bad enough sharing a front seat with a robot. I hate to take a back seat. Of course, if you don't think I'm capable of running this investigation, Commissioner.
It isn't that, Lige. It's not you, it's the spacers. You don't know what they're like.
Bailey deepened his frown. Well then, Commissioner, suppose you come along. His right hand rested on his knee, and two of his fingers crossed automatically as he said that. The commissioner's eyes widened.
No, Lash, I won't go there. Don't ask me to.
He seemed visibly to catch hold of his runaway words. More quietly, he said, with an unconvincing smile,
Lots of work here, you know. I'm days behind.
Bailey regarded him thoughtfully.
I'll tell you what, then. Why not get into it by trimension later on? Just for a while, you understand, in case I need help. Well, yes. I suppose I can do that.
He sounded unenthusiastic.
Good.
Bailey looked at the wall clock, nodded, and got up.
I'll be in touch with you.
Bailey looked back as he left the office, keeping the door open for a part of an additional second. He saw the commissioner's head begin bending down toward the crook of one elbow as it rested on the desk. The plainclothesman could almost swear he heard a sob.
Jehoshaphat, he thought, in outright shock.
He paused in the common room and sat on the corner of a nearby desk, ignoring its occupant, who looked up, murmured a casual greeting, and returned to his work. Bailey unclipped the baffle from the bowl of the pipe and blew into it. He inverted the pipe itself over the desk's small ash vacuum and let the powdery white tobacco ash vanish. He looked regretfully at the empty pipe, readjusted the baffle, and put it away. Another pipeful, gone forever. He reconsidered what had just taken place. In one way, Enderby had not surprised him. He had expected resistance to any attempt on his own part to enter Spacetown. He had heard the commissioner talk often enough about the difficulties of dealing with spacers, about the dangers of allowing any but experienced negotiators to have anything to do with them, even over trifles. He had not expected, however, to have the commissioner give in so easily. He had supposed, at the very least, that Enderby would have insisted on accompanying him. The pressure of other work was meaningless in the face of the importance of this problem. And that was not what Bailey wanted. He wanted exactly what he had gotten. He wanted the commissioner to be present by trimensional personification so that he could witness the proceedings from a point of safety. Safety was the key word. Bailey would need a witness that could not be put out of the way immediately. He needed that much as the minimum guarantee of his own safety. The commissioner had agreed to that at once. Bailey remembered the parting sob, or ghost of one, and thought,
Jehoshaphat, the man's into this past his depth.
A cheerful, slurring voice sounded just at Bailey's shoulder, and Bailey started.
What the devil do you want?
He demanded savagely. The smile on R. Sammy's face remained foolishly fixed.
Jack says to tell you Daniil is ready, Lige.
All right. Now get out of here.
He frowned at the robot's departing back. There was nothing so irritating as having that clumsy metal contraption forever making free with your front name. He had complained about that when R. Sammy first arrived, and the commissioner had shrugged his shoulders and said,
You can't have it both ways, Lige. The public insists that city robots be built with a strong friendship circuit. All right, then, he is drawn to you. He calls you by the friendliest name he knows.
Friendship circuit. No robot built of any type could possibly hurt a human being. That was the first law of robotics. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. No positronic brain was ever built without that injunction driven so deeply into its basic circuits that no conceivable derangement could displace it. There was no need for specialized friendship circuits. Yet the commissioner was right. The Earthman's distrust for robots was something quite irrational, and friendship circuits had to be incorporated, just as all robots had to be made smiling. On Earth, at any rate. R. Daniil, now, never smiled. Sighing, Bailey rose to his feet. He thought,
Spacetown, next stop. Or maybe, last stop.
The police forces of the city, as well as certain high officials, could still make use of individual squad cars along the corridors of the city and even along the ancient underground motorways that were barred to foot traffic. There were perennial demands on the part of the liberals that these motorways be converted to children's playgrounds, to new shopping areas, or to expressway or local way extensions. The strong pleas of civic safety remained unvanquished, however. In cases of fires too large to be handled by local devices, in cases of massive breakdowns in power lines or ventilators, most of all in cases of serious riot, there had to be some means whereby the forces of the city could be mobilized at the stricken point in a hurry. No substitute for the motorways existed or could exist. Bailey had traveled along a motorway several times before in his life, but its indecent emptiness always depressed him. It seemed a million miles from the warm, living pulsation of the city. It stretched out like a blind and hollow worm before his eyes as he sat at the controls of the squad car. It opened continuously into new stretches as he moved around this gentle curve or that. Behind him, he knew without looking, another blind and hollow worm continually contracted and closed. The motorway was well lit, but lighting was meaningless in the silence and emptiness. Ardenil did nothing to break that silence or fill that emptiness. He looked straight ahead, as unimpressed by the empty motorway as by the bulging expressway. In one sounding moment, to the tune of a wild whine of the squad car's siren, they popped out of the motorway and curved gradually into the vehicular lane of a city corridor. The vehicular lanes were still conscientiously marked down each major corridor in reverence for one vestigial portion of the past. There were no vehicles any longer, except for squad cars, fire engines, and maintenance trucks, and pedestrians used the lanes in complete self-assurance. They scattered in indignant hurry before the advance of Bailey's squealing car. Bailey himself drew a freer breath as noise surged in about him, but it was an interval only. In less than 200 yards, they turned into the subdued corridors that led to Spacetown entrance. They were expected. The guards obviously knew Ardenil by sight, and although themselves human, nodded to him without the least self-consciousness. One approached Bailey and saluted with perfect, if frigid, military courtesy. He was tall and grave, though not the perfect specimen of spacer physique that Ardenil was. He said,
"Your identification card, if you please, sir."
It was inspected quickly, but thoroughly. Bailey noticed that the guard wore flesh-colored gloves and had an all but unnoticeable filter in each nostril. The guard saluted again and returned the card. He said,
"There is a small men's personal here which we would be pleased to have you use if you wish to shower."
It was in Bailey's mind to deny the necessity, but Ardenil plucked gently at his sleeve as the guard stepped back to his place. Ardenil said,
"It is customary, Partner Elijah, for city dwellers to shower before entering Spacetown. I tell you this since I know you have no desire, through lack of information on this matter, to render yourself or ourselves uncomfortable. It is also advisable for you to attend to any matters of personal hygiene you may think advisable. There will be no facilities within Spacetown for that purpose."
"No facilities?" said Bailey strenuously. "But that's impossible."
"I mean, of course," said Ardenil. "None for use by city dwellers."
Bailey's face filled with a clearly hostile astonishment. Ardenil said,
"I regret the situation, but it is a matter of custom."
Wordlessly, Bailey entered the personal. He felt, rather than saw, Ardenil entering behind him. He thought,
"Checking on me? Making sure I wash the city dust off myself?"
For a furious moment he reveled in the thought of the shock he was preparing for Spacetown. It seemed to him suddenly minor that he might, in effect, be pointing a blaster at his own chest. The personal was small, but it was well-appointed and antiseptic in its cleanliness. There was a trace of sharpness in the air. Bailey sniffed at it
momentarily puzzled. Then he thought,
ozone. They've got ultraviolet radiation flooding the place.
A little sign blinked on and off several times, then remained steadily lit. It said, visitor will please remove all clothing, including shoes, and place it in the receptacle below. Bailey acquiesced. He unhitched his blaster and blaster strap and recircled it about his naked waist. It felt heavy and uncomfortable. The receptacle closed and his clothing was gone. The lighted sign blanked out. A new sign flashed ahead. It said, visitor will please tend to personal needs, then make use of the shower indicated by arrow. Bailey felt like a machine tool being shaped by long-distance force edges on an assembly line. His first act upon entering the small shower cubicle was to draw up the moisture-proof flap on his blaster holster and clip it down firmly all about. He knew by long-standing test that he could still draw and use it in less than 5 seconds. There was no knob or hook on which to hang his blaster. There was not even a visible shower head. He placed it in a corner away from the cubicle's entrance door. Another sign flashed, visitor will please hold arms directly out from his body and stand in the central circle with feet in the indicated positions. As he placed his feet in the small depressions allowed for them, the sign blanked out. As it did so, a stinging, foaming spray hit him from ceiling, floor, and four walls. He felt the water welling up even beneath the soles of his feet. For a full minute it lasted, his skin reddening under the combined force of the heat and pressure, and his lungs gasping for air in the warm dampness. There followed another minute of cool, low-pressure spray, and then finally a minute of warm air that left him dry and refreshed. He picked up his blaster and blaster strap and found that they, too, were dry and warm. He strapped them on and stepped out of the cubicle in time to see R. Daniil emerge from a neighboring shower. Of course, R. Daniil was not a city dweller, but he had accumulated city dust. Quite automatically, Bailey looked away. Then, with the thought that, after all, R. Daniil's customs were not city customs, he forced his unwilling eyes back for one moment. His lips quirked in a tiny smile. R. Daniil's resemblance to humanity was not restricted to his face and hands, but had been carried out with painstaking accuracy over the entire body.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.